thing I wanted to point out to start with is that individuals who are assigned the biological sex of female at birth and who identify as transgender are a very diverse group of individuals, and they use a variety of terminology to refer to themselves and their gender. Some FTMs, for example, identify as both male and female. Others identify as neither male nor female. So for the sake of uniformity in this study, I stuck with the term FTM because for consistency's sake, and also because it's what has traditionally been used in public health research. But I do want to make the disclaimer that the term FTM does refer to biological females who use a variety of terms to describe their gender. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the transgender population as a whole is medically underserved. In one recent study, 20% of transgender-identified participants reported problems obtaining healthcare services because of their gender identity. And this was actually more prevalent among FTMs than among the male-to-female participants. The majority of transgender research and outreach, what is out there, has tended to focus on the mental and sexual health of the male-to-female transgender population. And studies that have included both MTF and FTM participants tend to have much lower sample sizes for the FTM participants. And for those of you who were in the previous session, we heard about how the collection of sexual and gender identity information in government-sponsored national surveys is not required, which is also problematic. And the scarcity of research sadly leads to a lack of provider knowledge, which then translates into a lack of patient knowledge. FTMs face unique challenges in the area of their healthcare needs. They may be at risk for processes that are related both to their biological sex, so for example, cervical cancer, in addition to conditions acquired as a result of transitioning to a new gender. There have been some studies that indicate that there might be an increased risk of polycystic ovary syndrome from taking testosterone. However, FTMs are often unable to identify or access healthcare providers with any kind of an understanding of these issues. This dearth of FTM sexual health research has unfortunately led to a reliance upon studies conducted with populations of lesbians and women who have sex with women. And although the health risks are the same for both populations, FTMs definitely have unique risks and unique barriers to care. For this study, an anonymous internet-based survey was designed and distributed using convenience and snowball sampling. The recruitment process was facilitated with the support and assistance of individuals throughout the country who are active in the transgender and the lesbian, gay, and bisexual LGBT community, as well as people working in LGBT health. The survey was publicized using flyers locally and was also publicized online, including links to the survey that were posted on LGBT and transgender websites and email listservs. The data collection instrument was first reviewed by 4 experts, 1 measurement, and 3 FTMs, and then the study received Institutional Review Board approval and was pilot tested, and then was active on Zoomerang for 3 months. And as you can see, the eligibility requirements were that participants self-identified as FTMs, were 18 years of age or older, and currently living in the United States. The data collection instrument, the online survey, included 42 closed-ended and 3 open-ended questions, and the gender question was one of those open-ended questions. Participants were asked to fill in a blank. What is your gender? Excuse me. Data was exported from Zoomerang into Excel and then analyzed with SPSS. And as you can see, descriptive statistics were run, chi-square tests of independence, and as I mentioned earlier, the gender variable was not dichotomous. These quantitative findings were presented in the study results part 1, and a thematic analysis of the open-ended questions was conducted for the results part 2. The final sample size included 210 FTMs ranging in ages from 18 to 60 with a mean age of 30. And as you can see, the majority were Caucasian, living in urban settings, employed, insured, had a primary health care provider, and 70% indicated that they were currently taking testosterone. I would like to mention that this study actually included 5 sets of research questions, but in the interest of time for this 12-minute presentation, I decided to focus on 2 questions today. The first one being, do FTMs perceive themselves to be susceptible to gynecological and sexual health conditions? There was a survey question posed, do you consider yourself to be at risk for any of the following? As you can see, 11 conditions were presented here. Participants reported about 20% felt at risk for breast cancer and breast cysts. And I apologize that I did not list the frequencies here, but I do want to point out that for those participants who had had mastectomies, they experienced a much smaller perceived risk of both breast cancer and breast cysts. Less than 20% reported that they felt susceptible to polycystic ovary syndrome. And you can see that a very low percentage reported susceptibility to STDs and HIV/AIDS. The second research question addressed perceived barriers to gynecological and sexual health care. The study question was posed, if you have not received any of the above listed services, and there were a list of 9 sexual health care services and also an other option. And participants were asked, what are your reasons for not doing so? And asked to check all that apply. And I apologize for this very unattractive graph. But of the provided responses, the most frequently reported barrier was a fear or dislike of sexual health exams. Additionally, respondents reported that a previous negative experience with either a sexual health exam or a sexual health care provider had affected their decisions. Many respondents reported fear of gender discrimination from a health care provider, and that was actually reported as a barrier more frequently, the fear, than actual previous discrimination from a health care provider or a sexual health care provider. A smaller percentage of respondents reported refusal of medical treatment, just around 5%, and only 1% of respondents reported feeling that sexual health exams are unnecessary for FTMs, and just around 5% reported a belief that gynecological services do not match a male gender identity. As on the left here, cost and lack of insurance were also reported as barriers. A very large number of respondents, you can see off to the right, used the other field to specify reasons why they had not received sexual health care in general or specific health care services. Many respondents reported that they were too young for certain services, especially mammograms. And overwhelmingly, there was a recurring theme of a perception of low risk, often backed up by a healthcare provider's assessment. There was a feeling that services are not needed, especially reproductive health services, STD, STI screening, and HIV testing. And this was quite often attributed to sexual behavior from participants who indicated, for example, that they were having sex with non-male partners, they were monogamous, they were not having penetrative sex, or that they were not sexually active at all. I conducted a thematic analysis of the qualitative data. At the end of the survey, respondents were asked, is there anything about your experiences with gynecological or sexual health care that you would like to share? That's a very broad question, and the data that I received was very, very informative and rich. Some themes that were not addressed in the provided barriers were lack of sensitivity and respect by office staff, physical and psychological discomfort with exams, especially there was a lot of mention of the actual medical equipment used during exams being physically and psychologically discomfort. There were difficulties experienced finding trans-friendly providers and a lack of knowledge. One participant wrote, many providers just do not understand the need to continue to perform reproductive genital gynecological exams even after a person has started taking testosterone. Another wrote, it's not very clear if you need to continue OBGYN after hysterectomy and chest surgery. My current doc says no, past docs said yes, I'm going to go with a no, since I have less parts and do not pass as female anymore. It was very encouraging that many of the respondents reported positive experiences and acknowledged that sexual health services are important and beneficial for FTMs. One respondent summed it up when he called sexual health services a necessary evil. And I've included a couple of quotes here. I still seek out all the health care I need since I still have female anatomy. Although pelvic exams and pap smears aren't fun for anyone, I still do them because I care about my health. Another wrote, I have a fear of exams and misunderstanding from providers, but I have gotten care anyway. Oops. One of the strengths of this study is that FTMs were involved throughout the process with the design of the study, including the design of the consent form, the recruitment email, the data collection instrument, and were involved in the pilot testing. I chose to use the internet because the internet is frequently used by members of the transgender population both to access information and to connect with other members of the population. It also provides anonymity regarding a sensitive topic and can be convenient. However, any of you who have read up on internet-based research, it does have its limitations in reaching underserved populations. So this survey did allow me to access potential respondents throughout the United States, and it did elicit quite a large sample size for studies of its type, especially considering that it was only active for 3 months. But again, it may have failed to elicit a representative sample from an already hard-to-reach population. Underrepresented segments, for example, include FTMs of color, rural FTMs, uninsured FTMs, etc. And due to the non-random sampling and the use of internet research, these findings cannot be generalized beyond the study sample. In particular, because the topic was very sensitive, FTMs who are more likely to obtain gynecological services anyway may have been more likely to have participated in this study. For every sexual health condition presented in this survey, there were some FTMs who perceived themselves to be susceptible. However, respondents reported feeling most susceptible to breast cancer, cervical cancer, and ovarian cancer, but very few reported being susceptible to STDs, STIs, and HIV. The majority of respondents indicated that they were currently taking testosterone, 70%. And as I have mentioned before, previous studies suggest a high prevalence of polycystic ovaries among hormonally treated FTMs. However, less than one-fifth of respondents in this study perceived themselves to be susceptible to PCOS. Many FTMs articulated a tragic lack of knowledge about FTM sexual health risks and reported receiving unclear and even contradictory information from healthcare providers about susceptibility and prevention. And as I mentioned, underrepresented FTMs are more likely to experience barriers and are the ones who are least likely to be able to overcome those institutional barriers. And lastly, some recommendations. As I mentioned, many FTMs in this study reported very positive experiences with their sexual health care. Perhaps those FTMs could be employed as health educators and patient advocates. Healthcare providers could also have the potential to affect this perceived barrier of fear by conducting outreach to FTMs. They can continue their own education, provide sensitivity training for everyone in their office, use smaller instruments for sexual health exams, allow patients, partners, or patient advocates in the exam room, and basically do outreach to FTMs to let them know that they are attempting to provide culturally competent healthcare. And this study was a very, very first step in gathering some much-needed information, but I do want to get up on my soapbox for a minute and say that although healthcare providers can be educated about how to deliver sensitive care to FTMs that is respectful of their specific sexual health concerns, they simply can't deliver competent services to FTMs when they lack the knowledge to do so. Providers and public health professionals can't effectively communicate health risks when the exact risks and sexual health conditions for FTMs aren't known. So the knowledge required to create some clinical guidelines and standards is very necessary. And in order to communicate health risks and deliver this culturally relevant sexual health information, FTMs, it must stem from a sufficient body of valid published research. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. I think we have time for one or two questions.
And your question was simply about, oh, I'm sorry, could you repeat? I can let you know at the end of the session. I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head. Like I said, there was a lot of this study that I was not able to present today. I believe it was around 14%, but I did also look extensively at all other types of, there was a whole component to my study about sex reassignment surgery that included mastectomies, and I'd be happy to share that with you later. Sure.
Thank you. There's a movie that deals with this very issue, and it's very well known.
Certainly. Informally, I'll talk a little more informally about my methods for recruiting. When I started my MPH program, I knew that this was the study that I wanted to do, and so I started at, you know, 2 years ago I was here at APHA. I started collecting people's business cards, telling them about the research that I wanted to do, and so a lot of my contacts were academic. Not all of my contacts, but a lot of them were. I also have a lot of connections in Atlanta to local communities, and again, a lot of those communities are made up of very highly educated, more privileged white individuals. So I think that that had a lot to do with it. I was very excited to be able to reach such a large sample size. I had people from Canada taking this survey, and unfortunately I couldn't include them. There were some questions about what type of health insurance you have, and this one type kept popping up, and I thought, I don't know what that is. And then I found out that it was Canadian. So I really couldn't tell whether those people were living in the United States and had Canadian insurance, but unfortunately I had to exclude them.